It's time for Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you have a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now at 252-222-4848.
And we'd like to welcome Cecil Harvell on the line with us from Harvell and Collins. Good morning, Cecil. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very fine. And your partner in the firm is here as well, Wes Collins. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mike.
Looking good. Your jacket on there for the cool weather, as I just predicted.
Cool in the morning, warm in the afternoon.
Got to love it. You got to love Eastern North Carolina this time of the year. So, gentlemen, what's our topic of discussion? Are we going to continue what we were talking about last week or dive into a new arena?
No, let's continue that topic, maybe with a little bit of a different emphasis. But we were talking about payable on death accounts, time on death accounts, bank accounts or CDs, or even stock accounts that are joint with right of survivorship. Sometimes, Mike, these accounts are established without a full understanding by the client or by the owner of the account. They're in the bank. The bankers are busy. There are lines. People are waiting. They open up this account. The next thing you know, they put their child on the account, joint with right of survivorship. And there really wasn't a lot of conversation or understanding about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we see these files, you know, very, very often, but today I think we want to move into a little bit of a different category where children or an important person in one's life under the power of attorney begins to alter accounts in some way so that they are survivorship accounts to the particular person who is the agent under the power of attorney. So, in other words, we're moving a little bit into more of a category of there's some malfeasance here. There's some actions that are maybe not in the best interest of the entire family, but are in the best interest of the person who has, you know, the ear and control of mom or dad or granddad. And so I think we want to talk a little bit today about those kinds of cases. And I'll let Wes kind of take over and frame them up, but basically they kind of frame up in a breach of fiduciary duty category. Don't you agree, Wes?
Well, they do, or fraud.
Right.
I would say about half of the litigation cases that I have that deal with this particular issue, and when I say this particular issue, what I'm referring to is non-probate assets, meaning assets that pass by beneficiary designation or by joint with right of survivorship or payable on death, as compared to probate assets that pass under the will. But when those non-probate assets pass in a way that kind of raises your eyebrows, okay, what happened here? Why do I have the will, for example, leaves everything to the three kids, and this one or two accounts goes all to this one child.
Mm-hmm.
Or if there's, you know, circumstances involving when the document was changed, when was the signature card signed? So, Cecil, sometimes I see these signed through power of attorney, but just as many times I see these signed purportedly by the individual who owns the account, usually the
Correct.
Mother or the father. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that takes us down to pass. I've had many cases where my handwriting expert, upon examining the documents that are known signatures of the individual, could be from medical records, or could be from driver's license, or could be from the will that was signed in an attorney's office or power of attorney, whatever it may be, comparing that known signature to the purported signature on the change of beneficiary document or change of ownership document, and finds that this is not the signature of this person. So that takes us down the forgery route.
Fraud and forgery.
Fraud and forgery route. You know, or situations where it's signed through power of attorney, or in situations where maybe it was signed by the individual, but the evidence would be that this individual was being subjected to undue influence at the time. or lack capacity to make these type of decisions based on a diminished capacity, age-related issues in many cases, dementia-related issues, Alzheimer's, and you know the evidence that we get with regard to that normally kind of stems from medical records around the time, and then obviously from testimony of those who may have been around the individual, who could be hospice nurses or who could be neighbors or whomever it may be. So as you can tell, I've kind of meandered all through of the, through this because these type cases take all type of complexions. They look different depending on what the circumstances are. But a lot of times, Mike, these cases stem from what we were talking about before, what we talked about in the program before, which is a will caveat, where you file the caveat, you challenge the will, and then through the discovery process of gathering information regarding all of the estate that passes as a result of the death of the person, you learn about some of these things. And so I have a fair number of these cases, or have had and still have some now currently. I'm sure I'll have many in the future as well, if history is any indicator, that, you know, where you have the caveat, but you also have a companion case that goes along the lines of other non-probate documents being being challenged as well, based on some of those things I just mentioned, the fraud, the forgery, undue influence, lack of capacity, those type of things.
It sounds like...
Mike, let's back up a little bit and lay a few more things on the table.
Why not?
Sometimes what will happen is that an account has been established with right of survivorship or time on death, and then an account from some other place is closed, if you will, and is added to the account with these designations. So the account maybe used to be, let's say, $25,000, and now it's suddenly $125,000 because a CD matured, or there was certain, there was a property that was sold, whatever the case might be. So we also see where monies can land in these accounts, by happenstance. You know, we've pondered this subject on the radio with you, Mike, many times, actually, and I've written about it, Wes and I have written about it online. And there really is, I'd like to research this a little bit and report back, but I don't really quite understand the purpose, if you will, the overriding purpose of these time on deaths and payable on deaths and with right of survivorship. I really wish our law was rewritten to tighten up these kinds of designations, because we are just seeing an enormous amount of misunderstanding surrounding these accounts. One of the most common misunderstandings, Mike, to repeat, is, well, I think my daughter needs to be on my account so she can pay my bills. I've added her to my bank account so that she can pay my bills. Well, no, your daughter doesn't need to be on your bank account, particularly with it with right of survivorship or payable on death, to pay your bills. We have a power of attorney, remember, and you registered the power of attorney with the bank and or the stock company, and now the daughter has full access to the to your account and your monies in order to pay your bills. But without being, you know, a beneficiary on the account or a joint owner on the account. So, you know, it really is kind of a question here, what purpose, what's an overriding reason that these kinds of account designations exist. Another thing that you hear real quickly, and then I'd like Wes to chime in on why he thinks these laws exist with regard to these account designations. But one of the other things that we always hear, in addition to, well, I need my child to be able to pay my bill, is I want it to avoid probate. Okay? I want these accounts to avoid probate. Well, we really have to analyze that very carefully, because what if we don't have any money in the estate to pay the funeral bill or to pay the last expenses of the estate? What if, again, the account is registered in a way where it's disproportionate and not consistent with the terms of the will? So we are setting up a situation, maybe arguably it is said to avoid the probate process, when in fact the probate process is what's going to keep everybody on the straight and narrow and keep this family from completely falling apart. Keep in mind that when these accounts pass by operation of law, just with the death certificate within a day or two, sometimes these children aren't willing to ante back into the estate enough money to pay all of the expenses of the estate. And so we then have some disharmony in the family as a result of that. I guess the bottom line from my perspective is that I see more problems with these kinds of account designations than I do solutions. How about you, Wes?
Wes, what do you think?
Well, I think that obviously the banking industry is nationalized, and you know, our banking laws in North Carolina are basically the same as every other state. And I think that that in and of itself, years ago when this became more prevalent, meaning the designation of accounts that pass as non-probate assets, there was probably through the banking industry and perhaps the banking lobby an interest to attempt to streamline things for customers, number one, and number two, to avoid probate in states where probate expenses are excessive. And there are some states like that. North Carolina is not one of them. So that all sounds well and good, as a lot of plans do, until you start digging into it. But as Cecil identified, you know, you do end up at the kind of the grassroots level, which is where we are. We're dealing with these families. Yeah. We're dealing with them in the preparation of the documents. We're dealing with them upon a death. And we see the problems that are created by these, where there's, as I mentioned last week, there's so much time and effort and concentration in by the attorney and the attorney's office to make sure that everything is executed properly, that it's done consistent with the client's wishes, that all of the different variations of the particular family are addressed on the one hand, but then you know, you go into the bank and just sign a piece of paper and that's it. Yeah. And a lot of times that piece of paper is moving hundreds of thousands of dollars upon death. That's not really what's intended. It's done for purposes of allowing the daughter, for example, to be able to sign checks for bills, which is totally unnecessary. You need a power of attorney anyway to deal with other things. So there's a significant level of checks and balances in a will and making sure this is done properly. Two witnesses, obviously signed properly before the witnesses, all the details in North Carolina as it relates to that, but then basically no formality as it relates to a huge chunk of folks' estate. Moreover, you know, if we have someone come into our office and let's say the daughter is with the daddy and the daddy doesn't have the capacity to sign the will, well, there's a stop right there, because Mr. Harbell or Mr. Collins or Mr. Foster or whoever it is who's meeting with this person is going to put the brakes on that situation if it appears that there's possibly some undue influence, if it appears that the person doesn't have the capacity to sign the document. But let's contrast that to what happens in the banking world. Well, that's putting bank employees in quite a tight spot when you have a customer coming in saying he or she or whomever it is wants to sign a document to make a joint account or whatever. In my experience, I don't think the brakes are put on that situation that often. They are sometimes. And sometimes we even get calls to our office. Mr. Smith is here. So-and-so is with him. We have real concerns about this. We're going to hold off on this right now. That puts the bank in a really awkward position. Yeah. And it kicks it back to us, the lawyer, to kind of be the enforcer.
The bad guy.
You know, with regard to that.
Yeah.
Well, the right guy, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, but still, kind of the bad guy and the bad cop, good cop.
Right.
So be it as it may, it's just a dynamic that is too casual. It's just too casual, and what is intended to be accomplished through this casual execution of these documents creates other problems that just I don't think it were really contemplated when this became more prevalent, you know, years ago.
Yeah. It's a good point. Gentlemen, let's take a break on that. We'll continue our conversation with Harvell and Collins. Let's Talk Legal. If you'd like to reach out to the firm, call today, 252-726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. We'll be back with more of Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins after this break. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And Cecil, is there something, listener that is hearing this program this morning, is there something a family can do to be proactive so as to alleviate some of these situations that we described just in the last few moments?
Well, I just believe that it begins with awareness, and I'm just so thankful that we are able to, in our small way, put this out there so that more and more people who listen to the program, you know, hear that there are some real stops, there's some real calls for concern. We ask about this when we see clients and we're putting their estate plan together and their will. Just yesterday I had a lady in, and she was proceeding to tell me that her Fidelity account, her bank accounts, that they all were designated by beneficiary. And then lo and behold, when we got into the terms of her last will and testament that she's wanting us to put together, they were inconsistent with that. And so, you know, it was caught. And she, of course, it was brought to her attention, and she was, you know, very thankful and was going to go to the bank today and change some things around and contact Fidelity. I have my 10 o'clock client coming in this morning. It's a separate file at 10 o'clock. Very wonderful people from Beaufort. They're coming in today to sign after several redrafts of their trust agreement. And one of the things that I asked for them to do and to get to me before they signed today was their Merrill Lynch account a statement. I was very concerned that potentially there were designations on it that would be inconsistent with their last will and testament, which in their file could be a real problem in light of the fact that they're setting up a trust. So the point is that, you know, it's more, Michael, an information communication, getting this word out, having people aware of this. I do wish that Wes and I and Andrew and Julia had more help from the brokerage world. There are some brokers that we deal with who are wonderful, who are very aware of this and who actually will contact us and say, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, we're in. I want to go through with you, Cecil, how their accounts here are designated, because they do have some PODs. Can I go through those with you? PODs meaning payable on death. Mm-hmm. So it's out there. But then of course, you know, we also see those files where this just didn't get discovered. And then of course you have that layer of factual scenarios that goes to Wes's desk concerning someone, you know, closing out an account and adding it to account joint with them, or setting up an account that's joint with them where there's some sort of, as Wes was speaking earlier, fraud or duress or undue influence, yeah, breach of fiduciary duty, those issues.
Yeah, it's like not all families fall into these categories, but the definition or the delineation between malfeasance and fraud is pretty a pretty small delineation. You see it in situations where one child takes advantage of being close to mom, as an example, leaving the uh-huh. other siblings out, and that gets into the courts under a case of fraud.
Right, Mike. We were talking about that during the commercial break. You know, in one particular case I was mentioning, which is over now, I'm not going to mention any names, but generally what happened with that case, there was a will caveat, and then that led to a separate lawsuit. As I mentioned before, it happens sometimes that you have a separate lawsuit dealing with the non-probate assets. But what we learned through discovery, which wasn't clear from the beginning, mm-hmm. We had just a little bit of evidence of something that was going on, and then we had to use the rules of evidence to develop it. But what happened was the individual mother, who was in her 80s, had bonds of hundreds of thousands of dollars. She just physically had bonds, and each of these bonds were bonds with three of her children. But the children didn't know about the bonds. Nice. The children were just put on the bonds, right. And they were and bonds. It was the mother and child mm-hmm. bonds. So then the fourth child, who lived with the mother, took the mother to the bank and had the bonds liquidated. And then she put all of that hundreds of, and over half a million, when I say hundreds of thousands, in her own joint account.
Nice.
So around this point in time, the mother also signed a will indicating I'm not leaving anything additional to my other three children, not out of lack of love and affection, but because I've already given you your bonds.
Thinking that were,
so she were, she thought that they had gotten their hundreds of thousands of dollars of bonds. Well, no, everything went to the caregiver child, mm-hmm. okay? So we had to peel back the layers of the onion through discovery with regard to that, you know, finding that these bonds were taken to the bank for liquidation 2 days before mom went into the hospital for like 30 days because she had a really serious illness that came upon her and she was seemed as though she was going to die. Mm-hmm. She then got out, and then another set was taken right after that. We had to establish who took her there, and we were able to do that. Wow. It was the husband of the caregiver child. So it all just the truth will set you free, and the truth
is in the paperwork.
Didn't set that caregiver daughter free, but the others, it got us to the point where we could tell, you know, what happened there. So that's one of many cases we've dealt with those type of situations.
Very good. Wow, that is amazing. And the light of truth was shined on that. But now, is that yeah. case? Go ahead, Cecil.
Well, Mike, there's just so much to talk about in this area. I'm glad we've had a couple of programs on it. I mentioned earlier that a brokerage account might put the mutual funds and brokerage account, even the IRA, whatever the case might be, say a third, a third, a third, and they're three children. So our listeners are thinking to themselves, well, goodness gracious, Mr. Harvell, what in the world is wrong with that? My will does say three children. I do want everything divided a third, a third, and a third. And the brokers are they don't really know any different either. Just, you know, that's just the way it is. Well, see, Michael, that is a problem in a probate, in an estate, because what if everything goes out to the three children and there are no proceeds in the estate to settle the estate? Who's going to pay the funeral? Who's going to pay those last tax bills, if any? And there's been no publication to creditors. So suppose within the 3 months now we have a real significant bill to pay. A creditor makes a claim in the estate. The final medical bills, if any. So to deplete an estate to the dollar, I might add, to the penny, of no assets whatsoever, because everything at a bank or brokerage firm is a third, a third, a third, can create problems in the estate. The reason for that is because once the money has been dispersed to one of the three children, it might be that that child is not willing to take $10,000 and put it back into the estate in order to pay the bills, or $20,000, or whatever it might take. Once possession is 9/10 of the law, once the money's gone and not within the discretion of the executor, then there we are. It's very difficult for the executor to get the money back.
That makes sense. And, people don't think about that, when they have years ahead before the estate settles or the POD comes into play. I think what we've talked about today shines the light on that, as far as having a consultation with get some legal advice and get your plan set.
No doubt. I mean, I think that, you know, as Cecil was saying, just being informed about it is the first place to start, and this program, helps to get the information out. And furthermore, besides that, you know, get with someone like Mr. Harvell. You know, I do more of the litigation, but he's going to send you down the right path so that you don't have these type of issues within your family.